I'm so thankful for Adventist Heritage Ministries and what they are doing to help us not forget the past. Because God has told us that our only fear for the future is that we will forget the past and how God has led us. And so this weekend is helping us be able to remember the past that much better. So on behalf of everybody from the New York Conference, welcome to this special weekend.
It's good to see each of you here on this Friday evening. The Sabbath is coming on. And let's turn to number 381 in the church hymnal, the Seventh-day Adventist hymnal. Holy Sabbath, Day of Rest, a beautiful hymn for welcoming the Sabbath. Let's join together as we sing all four stanzas, Holy Sabbath, Day of Rest. Let's stand together as we sing.
Holy Sabbath, Day of Rest, by our Master richly blessed, God created and divine, set aside for holy time. Yes, the Holy Sabbath rest, by our God divinely blessed, it to us a sign shall be.
Of the Sabbath coming upon us in this special day when we look back how you led Hiram Edson with the fundamental beliefs of our church during a time of great discouragement. You brought him vision about the sanctuary and about many things that we hold so dear. So be with our meeting tonight. May we honor you in all that we do and say. In Jesus' name, amen.
It's always a privilege to be here at the Bay Knoll Church. If you detect a little hoarseness in my voice, I've come down with something today. So in full disclosure, I just want to let you know I'm praying I'll get through this program. What we're going to do this evening is to tell you some stories about some early Adventist hymns and invite you then to sing a stanza or two of each of the hymns that we'll be talking about. So if you can't see the screen over here, I would suggest moving to where you can see it. You'll get more out of the program, and you'll help me save my voice if you do that. And so that would be very helpful. The hymns that I've chosen for this evening relate to the four historic sites at Adventist Heritage Ministry, who is sponsoring this weekend, the four sites that we own. So we're going to start with some songs that relate to William Miller, and that would, of course, be the William Miller House. And then we will sing a few songs that relate to Joseph Bates. We own his home down in Fairhaven, Massachusetts, his boyhood home. Then Higher Medicine, and then Historic Adventist Village. So that will be the progression. Before we start singing a few songs, though, I want to read just a couple of quotations from some of our pioneers. We're going to start with G.I. Butler. Elder G.I. Butler was president of the General Conference for a number of years, and in his old age, he talked about the power of early Advent singing. And he says, there is a power in an Advent hymn sung from the heart. We must introduce into our worship more of the spirit of the Advent message. I long to see a revival of interest in these grand old hymns that have been associated so intimately with the advancement of the third angel's message all through the years. He was in his late 70s, early 80s when he said that at the General Conference of 1909. In 1941, Elder W.A. Spicer, another former president of the General Conference, recalled the following about James White. He says, I remember well as a boy in our church waiting for the preacher. Our backs were to the street door through which the minister would enter. Then suddenly the silence would be broken by a sweetly musical and strong, sure voice singing a familiar hymn. I can see the singer now, James White, silver-haired, coming down the aisle, beating time on his Bible and singing. By the time he had finished the first stanza and the chorus, the congregation had been caught and carried along in the spirit of it and was joining in. And then Elder Spicer concluded by saying, some of the voices in the seats where the elderly veterans sat might have been a bit overworn, but I would like to hear such singing again. Ellen White's granddaughter, oldest granddaughter, told me that she remembered her grandmother talking about his hymns, early hymns. Children, we must learn to sing the songs of Zion here if we would join the angel choir yonder. And in 1868, James White, in his autobiography, was already getting nostalgic for Millerite hymn singing. And he wrote in his autobiography, it is a fact that there was in those days, meaning in 1844, that there was in those days a power in what was called Advent singing, such as was felt by no other. So now we'll sing a song relating to William Miller. It's one that you know the tune to, so that's why I've chosen it, to help you get started singing this evening. And it is one that was sung by the Millerites. It came out in their 1842 hymnal and continued to be included in Seventh-day Adventist hymnals down through 1908. So, Prayer of the Church, an old Millerite hymn. How long, O Lord, our Savior, wilt thou remain away? Our hearts are growing weary of thy so long delay. Oh, when shall come the moment when brighter far than moon the sunshine of thy glory shall on thy people dawn. One of the young people that became a Millerite was Ellen Harmon. We know her better as Ellen White. And Ellen Harmon, as a young girl, sang a song. Well, this is my interpretation. Ellen White's granddaughter, oldest granddaughter that I've already mentioned, Ella Robinson, has left us a memory statement about songs that her grandmother enjoyed singing. And one of them was a little chorus, Angels Hovering Around. I'd never heard it when I read this memory statement years ago. And I thought, well, okay, it's just an old song. And I went looking for it and found it in our 1886 Hymns and Tunes. But then another time later, I was looking in the Millennial Harp, the Millerite hymnal, and there it was there, so I can't prove it. But my guess is that young Ellen, as a teenager, learned to sing this little Millerite chorus in 1840s. Now, the story, it's called Angels Hovering Around, and the story I want to share with you as to why I think this song is one, or the chorus, is one that Ellen continued to sing the rest of her life, is, and I could tell a number of stories, but this is a short one, so I'm choosing this one. In the last years of Ellen White's life, she lived at her home in Northern California, Elmshaven, which we just had the picture of. And Mrs. White was there in her home, and she was up here in her writing room on this particular day that this story happened. Elder A.G. Daniels, then president of the General Conference, came to visit Mrs. White at Elmshaven. And as he walked down the long hall from the west end of the house to her writing room, which was on the east end of the house, he walked into the room. She was seated in her lap chair there, and writing chair. Here's a picture of the chair, but it's not Mrs. White. That's Ellen White's secretary, Sarah McInturfer. But this is about the arrangement that the room would have been looking at, like the day that I'm telling you the story. So Elder Daniels walks in. Ellen White is seated in the writing chair there, and she looks up at him, and she says, Elder Daniels, it's good to see you. And he responded, yes, Sister White, it's good to see you also. And then I don't care if he was the president of the General Conference. I think he probably did a double take next, because she said, did you see the angel? And he said, no, I didn't see any angel. And she said, well, the angel messenger was here conversing with me and passed you in the hallway as you came down the hallway to my writing room. Now, with that kind of reality, seeing angels, as Ellen White often did in vision, why, you can understand why a little chorus like Angels Hovering Around would continue to be one that Ellen White sang the rest of her life. So we're going to sing this. We're only going to sing one stanza. It's got about 10 stanzas. We're only going to sing one stanza, and we'll sing it through twice. There are angels hovering round. There are angels hovering round. There are angels, angels hovering round. Okay, again. There are angels hovering round. There are angels hovering round. There are angels, angels hovering round. Another former Millerite or young Millerite preacher that we know about is Elder James White. He, of course, later married Ellen Harmon that we just talked about, and she became then Ellen White. James White was only 21 years of age when he became a Millerite preacher. And he tells about his first preaching trip in the winter, January, leaving Maine, his home in Maine, Palmyra, Maine, January of 1843, and being gone for about 4 months. And at the end of that 4 months, he reported that he had 1,000 converts. So he was a pretty good evangelist, I would say, also. And he describes in his autobiography how he had people throwing nails at him sometimes and snowballs at him. And, I mean, it was quite a mess that he had to put up with as a young Millerite preacher. But he describes in his autobiography the next song that we're going to sing a stanza of, You Will See Your Lord A-Coming. He says that when he got to Litchfield Plains, Maine, it was with difficulty, he said, that he made his way through the crowd in where they were holding the meeting, through the crowd up to the pulpit. And then to call the people to order, he said, the first words they heard from me were in singing, You will see a Lord a-coming, and your Lord a-coming. And then he quotes the stanza in his autobiography. He says, the reader certainly cannot see poetic merit in the repetition of these simple lines. And if he's never heard the sweet melody to which they were attached, he will be at a loss to see how one voice could employ them so as to hold nearly 1,000 persons in almost breathless silence. And then the sentence that I quoted earlier, he says, this is the context for it, but it is a fact that there was in those days a power in what was called Millerite Advent singing, such as was felt in no other. So we will do one stanza of You Will See Your Lord A-Coming. You will see your Lord A-Coming, you will see your Lord A-Coming.
We'll see your Lord a-coming in a few more days. Hear the band of music, hear the band of music, hear the band of music which is sounding through the air.
Now, in his autobiography, James Watt does not mention that on this particular occasion, clapping his Bible. We often have a tradition, and when we do Heritage Weekends, of James Watt coming in and clapping his hands with the Bible. This particular time, and often on our Heritage Sabbath, we'll sing this song. He doesn't actually put the two together here. We know from other sources that on occasion, to get the people to sing in time and rhythm, he would clap his hands, clap his Bible, tap his Bible as he came down the aisle to start a meeting. All right, we need to sing a Millerite camp meeting song. The Millerites had about 125 camp meetings, so we need to sing a camp meeting hymn. And there is no more powerful hymn, as far as I'm concerned, from the Millerite movement than Watch Ye Saints. Now, this was written in 1844, so you don't find it in the Millerite hymnals, because the last Millerite hymnal was published in 1843. It was written by Mrs. Phoebe Palmer, a convert to Millerism. She was converted by Charles Fitch. Fitch, if you remember anything about Adventist history, is the man, the minister, who died of pneumonia on October 14, 1844. So just 8 days before the great disappointment of October 22, Charles Fitch died. In September of 1844, he was in holding meetings in Ohio, and the story is told how he had a call, an altar call, inviting people to come give their hearts to Jesus because the Lord was returning, as they believed, in just a few weeks. And the story is that a big lubberly fellow, and a colorful word, a lubberly fellow started his way down the stairs from the balcony down to respond to the call. And he fell and stumbled, fell, and the people started laughing at seeing this man fall down the stairs. And Fitch shouted out, "It's better to stumble into heaven than to walk into hell." And that was the end of that. There was no more laughing. But as I say, he died, Charles Fitch died. But he's the one that converted Phoebe Palmer, the writer of this hymn. Now, an Adventist congregation cannot sing this sitting down. So you need to stand up to sing Watch Ye Saints. And we'll do three stanzas of this powerful old hymn.
Watch ye saints, with eyelids waking, lo, the powers of heaven are shaking. Keep your lamps all trimmed and burning, ready for your Lord's returning. Lo, he comes. Lo, Jesus comes. Lo, he comes. He comes all glorious. Jesus comes to reign victorious. Lo, he comes. Yes, Jesus comes. Lo, the promise of your Savior, pardoned sin and purchased favor, blood-washed robes and crowns of haste to tell redemption's story. Lo, he comes. Lo, Jesus comes. Lo, he comes. He comes all glorious. Jesus comes to reign victorious. Lo, he comes. Yes, Jesus comes. Sinners, come while Christ is pleading now for you. He's interceding. Haste their grace, the time diminished. Lo, he comes. Lo, he comes. He comes all glorious. Jesus comes to reign victorious. Lo, he comes. Yes, Jesus comes.
You may be seated. All right, we're going to move now to the second site that Adventist Heritage Ministry owns, and that is the Joseph Bates Home. It's our most recent purchase. We've just owned it for about 4 years, and it desperately needs help. The president and I were just there a few days ago, and it needs a lot of help. I'll tell you, it was built in about 1742, so it's not the newest thing on the block, as you can tell from that vintage. Anyway, Elder Joseph Bates, one of the co-founders of our church. The first hymn that I have chosen for us to sing, here's a picture of Elder Bates, is not one that I can actually tie directly to Joseph Bates with a story, but it so typifies the man. And it is a hymn that was in our very first 1849 hymnal, the first hymnal that James White put out. So I'm certain that Elder Bates sang it on occasion, but it does typify him. This one thing I do is sort of the way I picture Joseph Bates, a man of determination, knew exactly what he was doing and where he was headed. He often said things like, "The Lord will provide." Many stories about Joseph Bates where he would say, "Well, the Lord will provide." Another thing, because he was the one that introduced the Sabbath most widely in our midst. He wasn't the one that actually introduced it. That's Rachel Oaks up in Washington, New Hampshire. But most widely introduced it, including introducing James and Ellen White to the Sabbath. Elder Bates used to say, "Oh, how I do love this Sabbath." He would get so excited and wound up about the Sabbath. Prior to 1850, when Joseph Bates' wife accepted the Sabbath, Joseph Bates himself accepted it in 1845. But for 5 years, his wife didn't go into this new belief with him. She'd been with him on the Second Coming and the Millerite movement, but she wasn't so sure about this Sabbath business. But prior to 1850, Elder Bates would drive his wife, good gentleman, good husband that he was, would drive his wife to church on Sunday. And, of course, all the good folk that knew he used to be going to that church, attending that church, they would see him there. They knew exactly why he wasn't going in. He wasn't going to go in on the Pope's Sabbath, as he referred to it. He was coming in, he was keeping his own Sabbath the day before. And then, of course, he would come back. So when they're all coming out of church, when the service is over, here comes Elder Bates, and he's sitting there in his buggy again to pick up his wife. So he had two silent little Bible studies, well, not a Bible study, but study at least, witness program going every Sunday when he would take his wife to church. One time he was traveling. He had no money. He felt he needed to go. Story is told how he would, on this particular occasion, he got on the train. He knew that the conductor was going to come around and take the tickets, the money for the tickets, but he had no money. And that didn't bother him. The Lord will provide. And a gentleman walked up to Elder Bates, said, "Are you Joseph Bates?" "Yes." He said, "Fine, I have some money for you." He gave him $5, which was exactly what Joseph Bates needed for his train fare. In 1849, he was the first Sabbath-keeping Adventist minister to go to the state of Michigan, preach in Michigan. He was often gone over the winter months. As soon as it would start getting cold, he would go for five, six months preaching, walking much of the way, or hitching a ride with somebody. At the age of 65, they chopped a hole through 3 feet of ice for a baptism in Monterey, Michigan, in minus 30 degree temperature. It was all in a day's work for Elder Bates. One last story before we sing the first song about relating to Elder Bates. Elder Bates went one time out to see a family in the country near Battle Creek, Michigan. Some felt that Elder Bates was so strict that he, in his beliefs and in the way he lived his life, as they said, that he stood so erect, some felt he leaned over backwards. But he was very conservative in his approach to things. Anyway, this particular family, the Stites family, Mr. Stites, the father, was ill. There were no sons in the family, but there were two daughters in their teens. When Elder Bates was ready to leave, the younger of the two girls, named Deborah, harnessed up the horse to the buggy to take him into town. Courteously, Elder Bates thanked Deborah for her thoughtfulness, and here is what he is quoted as having said on that occasion. "My daughter, the Bible tells us to avoid the very appearance of evil. There are wagging tongues in the world, and a young woman must keep her name above reproach. Just now, it is in my keeping, and I cannot allow you to drive me in." So despite the protests, he picked up his heavy satchel and footed his way into town. You can see why people thought he was very strict, but he believed in a code of ethics, and he lived his life by what he understood was proper Christian decorum. "Jesus, I my cross have taken," from our very first hymnal, 1849.
Jesus. Jesus, I my cross have taken, all to leave and follow Thee. All things else I have forsaken, Thou from hence my all shall be. Perish every fond ambition, all I've sought or hoped or known, yet how rich is my condition, while I prove the Lord my own.
This was a friend of Joseph Bates living in Fairhaven, Massachusetts. His name was Heman Gurney. Brother Gurney was a blacksmith, and the time of the story is much younger than this, the only known photograph of Gurney. But Gurney was known as a singing blacksmith, actually. He was a Millerite, and then became a Sabbath keeper. Was one of the early ones to accept the visions of Ellen White as being from the Lord. But he was a singing blacksmith. There are several blacksmiths in Adventist history that used to sing as they'd pound away at their anvils. And so there's three or four of them that are called singing blacksmiths when we talk about our history. Gurney was one of those singing blacksmiths. In his autobiography written in 1868, Joseph Bates tells a story about how in early 1844, March of 1844 to be precise, Bates wanted to go from their home in Fairhaven, Massachusetts, down into Maryland. Many years earlier, Bates had been shipwrecked, and some people helped him and helped him save his life, actually. And now with his belief that Jesus was coming in just a few days, because we're talking now about the spring of 1844, before they even refocused on October 22. So Joseph Bates wants to go down and tell these people, see if he can find this family that had helped rescue him many years earlier. And so he said to Heman Gurney, this singing blacksmith, young man, he said to him, I would like you to come with me and sing as I hold meetings. Now, Gurney wasn't too excited about going down into Maryland. Even though Maryland, pre-Civil War, Maryland was a slave-owning state. According to the census records, it also had a lot of free blacks, but it had a number of slaves. And so this 1844 is before the Civil War, of course. But Gurney had heard how when the Millerite preachers would go down into the South, often the owners of the slaves would get very agitated, and they would not want Millerite preachers down there, because they thought all you're coming down here to do is just get our slaves excited and getting them to run away. So Gurney was not too excited about going down into Maryland, a slave-owning state. Bates said to him, well, I'll tell you what, will you go with me just as far from Fairhaven down around, you know, Philadelphia, because William Miller is going to be preaching. And if you'll come that far with me, travel that far with me, then if you decide you don't want to go on into Maryland, that's fine. You can come back home, and I'll go into Maryland by myself. Well, after Gurney had heard Miller preach, it was all over for him. He was going with Bates. And so then Bates tells a story that relates to the song that we're going to sing next. He describes how at one of the meetings that they were holding there on Kent Island in Maryland, or just near Kent Island, the owners of the slaves in that area had actually given permission for the slaves to attend the meetings. That didn't always happen. But on this particular occasion, the owners had given permission. And so Bates describes how seated in the room were the free people, and I assume that that would be mostly whites. There may have been a few free blacks. Bates doesn't clarify. But he says standing around the edge of the room were a number of slaves. After the meeting, Gurney sang the song that we're going to be singing in a minute, I'm a Pilgrim and I'm a Stranger. After the meeting, one of the slaves came to the lodging place where Bates and Gurney were spending the night and asked if he could have a copy of that hymn. Gurney said, well, I don't have anything but the copy I was singing from. Those words are all I have. And the man would not be just pushed, brushed aside easily. He said, I must have a copy of that. I must have a copy of that. I'll give you a quarter of a dollar. Now, 25 cents today means nothing, but when you put yourself back in the context of the 1840s, the average daily wage for just a common laborer in the United States in the 1840s was 50 cents a day. So 25 cents for that song, you know it meant an awful lot to that slave. Well, Gurney didn't have another copy, so he wrote off the words, and the man went away rejoicing. Now, base does not describe at all any more than what I just told you. But here's how I picture what happened that evening. Standing in the back of the room, not on the side, but in the very back, is an older black man. In my imagination, he has white hair. He is a bit stooped because, you see, he's a field slave. He's not a domestic slave. And as Brother Gurney began to sing this hymn, "I'm a pilgrim and I'm a stranger. I can tarry but a night." In my imagination, I see tears begin to flow down that dear old brother's cheeks as he realizes there's something better than this life of bondage. Thank goodness the United States abolished legal slavery well over 100 years ago. But we're still slaves where we don't belong. We all are citizens of a better country. So we could still sing this old hymn with feeling like meant so much to that dear brother that evening back there in 1844. "I'm a pilgrim and I'm a stranger. I'm a pilgrim and I'm a stranger. I can tarry but a night. Do not detain me, for I am going to where the fountains are ever flowing. I'm a pilgrim and I'm a stranger. I can tarry, but I'm not." In the very early days of our movement, probably Joseph Bates brought in as many new converts as any of the ministers. And one of the converts that he brought in, he converted to the Sabbath, was a young lady, Annie Smith, the older sister of Uriah Smith, that most of you, if you know anything about Adventist history, have heard about. Annie Smith and Uriah had both been Millerites, just trying to condense their story very quickly. After the disappointment in 1844, both Annie and Uriah gave up their interest in spiritual matters, and both decided they were going to get an education and make something of themselves. Now, this was especially unusual for a woman in that time to get a formal education, but Annie went to school and did that. But, of course, Annie's mother, Uriah's mother, she was very concerned about these two talented children of hers. And so when Joseph Bates came through where they lived about 1851 in West Wilton, New Hampshire, Rebecca Smith, the mother, appealed to Elder Bates. He said, "Where are you going next?" "Well, I'm going on to Boston." "Well, when you're there, would you look up my daughter? Please invite Annie to come to your meetings." Well, Elder Bates said, "She doesn't know me. I've never met your daughter. But I tell you what, if you would write to her, and if you would invite her to come to my meetings, they're going to be held in the home of a sister temple. Just tell her to come, and probably she'd be more apt to come if you invited her than if I did." And so that was what was agreed to. Well, the night before the meetings were to open, Annie Smith had thought, she didn't have any interest in religion, but she thought, "Well, I'll make Mother happy, so I'll go to the meetings." And that night she had a dream, and in this dream she saw herself coming in late. She saw in the dream, coming into the room where the meeting was being held, no seats were left. She sits down right next to the door. There's only one chair left. That's it. And she sees a man up in front. In some way, it was indicated to her in the dream that he was preaching truth. That same night, interestingly, Joseph Bates had exactly the same dream, but from the other end of the room. He saw a young lady come in late. He had already started his topic, and it indicated some way to him in the dream that he should speak on the heavenly sanctuary. So he changed his topic right in midstream. I've often wondered if the audience even noticed, but anyway, that's what he did. And so neither one knowing that their dreams are going to be acted out the next night. Annie thought she had directions to the sister temple's house. Plenty of time. She's going to get there in plenty of time. She gets lost. For any of you that rely on GPSs, there were no GPSs in those days. So she got lost and found herself coming in late, looking around the room. Only one seat right there by the door. And there's the man that she had seen. Now Joseph Bates at the other end sees the young girl that he'd seen in the dream the night before. And so he switches the topic to talk about the heavenly sanctuary. You can imagine they had a lot to talk about when that meeting was over. and within a couple of weeks, Annie Smith had become a Sabbath keeper. She was very talented. The picture there is thought to be a self-portrait. It's painted by Annie Smith, thought to be a self-portrait, still is in the Smith family, the painting is. And she also wrote poetry, and eventually she became an acting editor. I don't know if she had the title, but she certainly served as an acting editor of the Review, our church paper, when James White was traveling. One of the songs that Annie Smith wrote, well, it was a poem, but it was set to music, is "I Saw One Weary, Sad and Torn." It has four stanzas. Tradition is that when she wrote the first stanza, she was thinking about Joseph Bates. The second stanza, the tradition is that she was thinking about James White. Third stanza, well, there's a little debate about who she was thinking about there. Some people think that she was thinking about Jane Andrews. But the problem was Jane Andrews hadn't even become a Sabbath keeper yet, so he hadn't given up anything. So whether that's what you think about, remember this is printed in 1852. So who was she thinking about? Well, actually, he had accepted the Sabbath of 1852. I misspoke on that. But he hadn't gone overseas as a missionary. That's what I should have said. He hadn't gone overseas as a missionary, so he hadn't gone anywhere yet. She may have had a crush on him, so she may have been thinking about him. That's true. There is some evidence that Annie Smith had a crush on Jane Andrews, but he didn't return the favors. But there's a family tradition in the Leonard Hastings family, the closest family to the Smith family at that time, that in this third stanza she's actually talking about herself. But no self-respecting woman would have been so brazen as to make it obvious. So she changed the pronouns, and so she talks about him. "And there was one who left behind the cherished friends of early years, and honor, pleasure, wealth resigned to tread the path bedewed with tears. Though trials deep and conflicts sore, yet still a smile of joy he wore." Well, according to the family next door, or just down a couple of miles, Leonard Hastings, it should have been she, they thought. But anyway, she is probably talking about herself, but doesn't want to make it obvious if it's going to be printed in the Review that she's talking about herself. "I asked what buoyed his," or should say her, "spirits up. Oh, this said he or she, the blessed hope." The last stanza is about all of us, and that's the stanza we're going to sing. We're going to go back and sing. I guess what I see what's on here is the first stanza, which is about Joseph Bates. So let's do the first stanza of this hymn. "I saw one weary, sad, and torn, with eager steps press on the way, along the hallowed cross and bore, still looking for the promised day. While many a line of grief and care upon his brow was furrowed, we're going to sing a hymn now that relates to Hiram Edson. We bought the Hiram Edson farm in 1989, so we've had it considerably longer than the Bates house. I only have one song in this program about Hiram Edson. Here's a picture of this gentleman whose place we'll be out at tomorrow afternoon. And this is the hymn, "Here Is No Rest." The story that Edson himself tells about this particular hymn, the setting for the story is shortly before the Great Disappointment of October 22, 1844. Edson had been out circulating papers during the day, giving out Millerite publications, and they were holding meetings in the evening. Jesus was coming. They had to warn as many people as possible. One evening at their meeting, a two-horse wagon full of people pulled up. Total strangers, but quickly they made room for these strangers to join them in their meeting. And they opened the meeting by singing, "Here Is No Rest." Edson recalled, and I'm quoting now from Hiram Edson, "It was sung with the spirit and with the understanding, and the spirit which accompanied the singing gave to it a keen edge." Before the hymn was even completely finished, all the stanzas of it they'd sung, before they'd even finished singing all of them, the newcomers all decided, no, we're not going to let ourselves get converted here at this Millerite meeting. So they all decided to take off and leave right in the middle of the song. Well, one couple did get out of the meeting, but the rest ended up staying. That couple that couple walked 5 or 6 miles that night back to their home carrying a one-year-old child. The other 13 were converted to Millerism that night, according to Hiram Edson. But even the couple that had left, the conviction of just singing the hymn, and then I suppose talking to their friends the next day, was the conviction was so deep that they needed to come back, that they were there the following evening. And Edson said they too became Millerites. So this is the hymn that moved the congregation that night, and especially this group of newcomers that had not been to the Millerite meetings before. Here o'er the earth as a stranger I roam. Here o'er the earth as a stranger I roam. Here is no rest, is no rest. Here as a pilgrim I wander alone. Yet I am blessed, I am blessed. For I look forward to that glorious day when sin and sorrow will vanish away. My heart doth leap while I hear Jesus say, there is rest, there is rest. The last of the four sites that are owned by Adventist Heritage Ministry is Historic Adventist Village in Battle Creek, Michigan, a 3-block campus with historic buildings and replicated buildings on it. And the first hymn that we're going to do is one that was written by Uriah Smith. Now, we sang a hymn, well, that's not Uriah Smith, but we sang a hymn written by Annie Smith, the older sister of Uriah Smith, but the next hymn was one that was written by Uriah Smith in 1853, O Brother Be Faithful. Now, what Uriah Smith has done in the hymn that we'll be singing in a minute is taken a secular tune, song with secular words and secular tune, and put religious words to them. And that was very typical back in those days. You've got to remember a couple of things. One is that our pioneers did not use musical instruments in the early days in their meetings. So to keep everybody singing together, why, you needed to have people singing tunes that they knew. And the gulf between secular and religious society was not as wide as it is today. So, and it was just the Sabbath-keeping Adventists that did this. This is a quote from a Methodist songster printed in 1858, and I'm going to quote what it says there. Whenever, and it's talking about the early Methodists, whenever the Methodists found that the devil had got a good tune that seemed to charm the people, someone immediately composed a hymn or spiritual song to that tune, and thus cheated Satan out of both tune and singers. So we were not alone in this practice of taking secular tunes and putting religious words to them. Now, as I mentioned, we had no musical instruments in those days, and this brother, Joseph Clark, went to one of the meetings, and he later described in the Review in 1859 what it was like to go to one of those meetings back before we had musical instruments, used musical instruments in our churches. He says, I lately attended a conference where the brethren and sisters from different sections were gathered, and it was good to see them there. But alas, when we sang, one prolonged a quarter note until it consumed the time of a whole note with a hold and swell besides. Some were singing one verse until others had progressed pretty well into the next. And the ending word of each verse echoed and re-echoed, each according to the different notions of propriety which each locality administered for itself. It would be too much to suppose, Clark says, it would be too much to suppose that different voices from different places with different styles of singing should sing in perfect harmony. But certainly, it might be very much improved! Exclamation point. All right, so Uriah Smith takes a secular tune, be kind to the loved ones at home, and stands about be kind to your father, and next stands about your mother and your brother and your sister, and he takes that and he writes the words to the hymn that we're going to be singing. There's Uriah Smith. Many, many years, he was associated with our church paper, The Review, for about 50 years. For 25, 30 of those years, he was actually editor of the paper. He, at the age of 12, had his leg amputated. When I was in college, a few semesters back, when I was in college, I was talking with Elder Ernest Lloyd, who had been an office boy at the Review for Uriah Smith and others there at the Review about the turn of the century, 100 years, 110 years ago. And he said that if you didn't know that Uriah Smith had a wooden leg, you would never have noticed it by watching him walk the streets of Battle Creek. Elder Smith had invented and patented, actually, a limb with a movable ankle. And apparently that's what he used the rest of his life also, as well as making money off the patent. In fact, Ernest Lloyd, who later would become editor of The Little Friend for 25 years, by the way, Elder Lloyd told me, he said that when Uriah Smith would walk the streets of Battle Creek, not only did you not see his limb, but that he was so impeccably dressed and he was so distinguished in appearance that people, would, even men, would turn and look at this distinguished-looking gentleman. He had a large notice on his door at the Review in large purple letters. Here's what it said. Editor's room. Busy? Yes, always. If you have any business, attend to your business and let us attend to our business. It kept the office boys from standing around too much, standing around in front of Uriah Smith's office door. All right, one stanza of O Brother, Be Faithful, written by Uriah Smith in 1853. How old was Uriah Smith in 1853? We think of these long-bearded patriarchs. He was 21 when he wrote this. Oh, brother, be faithful, soon Jesus will come, for whom we have waited so long. Oh, soon we shall enter our glorious home and join in the conqueror's song. Oh, brother, be faithful, for what should we prove? To him who has shown such deep, such unbounded and infinite love. The oldest home that we have in Battle Creek, and actually the oldest standing Adventist landmark, it's still standing there in Battle Creek, is the James and Ellen White home on Wood Street. Just a word about James and Ellen White's home. Many, many years later, in fact, the family moved out of this home about 1863. So this would be now about 1933 or 34, somewhere in there. W.C. White, the son, the third son of James and Ellen White, recalled what it was like to grow up in this house. In fact, many of the things, if you ever get to Battle Creek and you look at the way the house is set up today and some of the things that we display there are reflections of what Willie White recalled happening in some of the rooms of the house. But he recalled that they would start their morning worships by singing a hymn such as Lord in the Morning. That's the hymn we'll be singing in a minute. And he said after they had sung that or some similar hymn, then his father, James White, if he wasn't traveling and was home, James White would lead out in worship. And, of course, part of worship was prayer. And here's what W.C. White, he's thinking back on when he's just a very young child, and now he's 80 or so years of age when he writes this, thinking back on his father's prayers. He, that's James White, he did not, and he put quotations around the next three words, offer a prayer. So he says about his father, he did not offer a prayer. He prayed with earnestness and with solemn reverence. He pleaded for those blessings most needed by himself and his family and for the cause of God. We have other accounts of James White's prayers, not just the ones that took place here, but other people writing and recalling many years later about James White's prayers. One lady, I was reading her accounts and remembering Elder White and his prayers, said that James White, when he would pray, would lift you to the very vestibule of heaven in his prayers. He must have been a powerful prayer warrior. Now, this hymn that we'll be singing was not just used for worships, but it was also used on the morning of October 1, 1860, when they had the opening meeting on that day, October 1, 1860, of what was not a general conference, because we hadn't organized a general conference yet, but they called them general conferences meeting. They had invited delegates to come in from all over the place, and so there were 20 or so delegates there. And at sunrise, they believed in getting the day started right. At sunrise, they opened the meeting, and they sang the hymn, Lord in the Morning. Now, that day is significant in Adventist history because it's October 1, 1860. That's just a few weeks from now. It'll be the 150th anniversary. And what did they do on that particular day? They chose the name Seventh-day Adventist. And some of us at the General Conference are trying to encourage as many of our churches as possible on the 150th anniversary, the closest Sabbath is October 2, to do something in your church about reflecting on what does it mean today, 150 years later, to be a Seventh-day Adventist. If your church closed here in Bay Knoll, would anybody even notice? I mean, that kind of thing. Some of our churches, yes, the community would notice if it closed. Tragically, other churches, probably not. And if that's the case, then we need to figure out why. Does nobody even know we're in town anymore? Anyway, so that 150th anniversary of when this song was sung is coming up in just a few weeks from now. This is the resolution from printed, a copy of the resolution from the review, saying resolved that we call ourselves Seventh-day Adventists, voted October 1, 1860. And this is the song they sang, and I think it's one that probably most of you know, Lord, in the Morning.
Lord, in the morning thou shalt hear my voice ascending up. To thee will I direct my prayer, to thee.
This is the first replica of an early Adventist building that we have built in the village. It's a replica of the second meeting house. The second meeting house was extremely significant in the history of the church. They only used it for 10 years, from 1857 to 1867. The original doesn't stand any longer, which is why we built this replica. It cost us considerably more than what it cost them back there in 1857. Back then, they paid $881.39 to build this church, 28 by 44 feet. Well, if you had come to Battle Creek on Wednesday night, May 20, 1863, you knew exactly why you were there. Because you were responding to a notice placed on the back page of the review by James White and a couple other ministers, inviting the conferences, the local conferences, to send delegates to Battle Creek because we needed to do business. We had 7 local conferences in those days, and 6 of them sent delegates. Vermont did not for whatever reason, but the other 6 all did. And so there they came, and they gathered that Wednesday night, May 20, 1863. The next day, May 21, 1863, they actually voted a constitution and organized the General Conference of Seventh-day Adventists. So that 150th anniversary is coming up in about 3 years. But back to Wednesday night, someone stood up and announced the opening hymn. We don't know who led the congregation in singing it, but it was a hymn written by Annie Smith, who had died in 1855, 8 years earlier. But it was a hymn that meant much to them, and I'm certain it was meant especially to Uriah Smith. Long upon the mountains weary, have the scattered flock been torn? In other words, they had been disorganized. Now they're coming together to organize. Dark, the desert paths and dreary. Grievous trials have they borne. It wasn't easy being a Sabbath keeper in those days. But now the gathering call is sounding, solemn in its warning voice. When you became a Seventh-day Adventist in those days, you took it seriously. This was not just a lightly made decision to become a member of the remnant church. Union, faith, and love abounding. Wish we could get that going in the church again. Bid the little flock rejoice. So this is the hymn that they used that Wednesday night. The next day we organized the General Conference of Seventh-day Adventists. But this was the opening hymn for what became the first session of the General Conference of Seventh-day Adventists.
Long upon the mountains weary, scattered flock been torn, dark the desert paths and dreary, grievous trials have they borne. Now the gathering call is sounding, solemn in its warning voice. Union, faith,
and back in those days, in 1860-70, especially in the 1870s, we were known as a temperance movement. We organized a temperance association. John Harvey Kellogg became the president of the American Health and Temperance Association. In fact, we emphasize temperance so much, we even brought out a hymn book, Temperance and Gospel Songs, edited by James Edson White, the son of James and Ellen White, second son of James and Ellen White. When you went across country in those early days, we're going to sing a temperance song out of this book in a minute, but when you went across country in those days on the transcontinental train, you really faced some things a little differently than you face today, because they didn't have non-smoking rooms and those kind of things, nor did they have a place where the men weren't to chew and spit and all that. And so here's a lady who went across country on the transcontinental train just shortly after it opened in 1869, and she wrote about it. And here's what she said, just a little bit of her article that she wrote. The men chew and spit. They read and spit. They talk and spit. They laugh and spit. They breathe and spit. And some swear and spit. There's a little chewing tobacco, I would say, going on the train. By lamplight as by daylight, the process went on. And what a scene did the flickering lights dimly disclose. Men, shaken equally out of their starch and out of their dignity, tumbling and rolling every way. Some from their horizontal positions, spitting out now more directly upon their neighbors. Women, cuddled up on the seats, evidently ill at ease, and starting even in their slumbers, as well they might amid these threatening showers. So when they sang a song like this, smoking and chewing, they were singing about something that was a real situation that they had to face. Now, because I had a little problem getting the program started, we're only going to do one stanza of this hymn, but that'll still give you the flavor of the song. So one stanza of smoking and chewing song. Chewing in the parlor, smoking in the street, choking with cigar smoke, everyone you meet. Spitting on the pavement, spitting on the floor. Is there such enslavement? Is there such a bore? Chewing, smoking, spitting, choking, sending clouds a-whirling in everybody's face. Chewing in the parlor, spitting on the floor. Is there such enslavement? Is there such a bore? Now, actually, we're not going to sing the stanzas tonight, but it gets worse. It doesn't get better. It's the next stanza, I'll just read it quickly. Puddles in the corners, puddles in corners, swelling into one, forming lakes and rivers, drying in the sun. Maidens never marry men who smoke or chew. If they use tobacco, they will never do. And then the third stanza, many carry spices, cinnamon, and cloves. Make use of your eyesight, make use of your nose. For when you are married, spice they throw away. And your loving husband smokes and chews all day. So, young people enjoy this song, and it might be one that would help us if we would sing some of these old temperance songs. All right, so we're not going to take time this evening to do that, but I just want to tell you, you can update these songs. A few years ago, I was leading a tour, and I had my church history teacher on the tour. There were two of us. There were guides on this particular tour, and my church history professor was asked by the conference president to join me in leading this New England tour for his pastors. And I got to the Washington, New Hampshire church, and we sang this song. I thought probably that my professor would contact the registrar's office and have him change my grade, you know, for doing something like that. But anyway, he didn't. He was very moved, actually. And he wrote another stanza. And we're not going to take time to sing it this evening either, but here's what he wrote and sent it to me. Smoking marijuana, getting awful grades, using dirty needles, risking death with AIDS, dodging knives and bullets, dropping out of school, facing time in prison. Why? Be such a fool. So you can update these old songs also. All right, I think, Lewis, we're going to skip the next song, and we're going to move on because the clock is moving on also. If you're going to talk about the pioneers of this church, there are some topics that obviously stand out. I won't do this one. And one of the topics, of course, is the second coming of Christ. There have been many hymns that have been sung by our pioneers down through the years about the second coming of Christ. We don't sing as many of those songs as we used to, unfortunately. The one that was probably the most popular in this church for 75 years or more was Lift Up the Trumpet. It was introduced into Adventist hymnody the 1866 hymns and tunes, and continue to be sung right on down with power, clear down to, I suppose, when they introduced We Have This Hope, and that's kind of replaced it some. But up till then, I don't think there was any song that could move an Adventist congregation quite like Lift Up the Trumpet. The older members here, you'll remember that for many, many years, the Voice of Prophecy started their broadcast every week with the King's Herald singing Lift Up the Trumpet. And those of you that went to meetings back in the 50s and 40s and well, maybe even the early 60s, you'll remember that if you went to a big meeting and Brad and Ollie Braley were there on the organs up in the front, and they might even have the King's Heralds come out with herald trumpets and sing Lift Up the Trumpet. Why, if you were anything like me, I'll tell you, it sent chills up and down my spine as a kid growing up in this church. You can't sing this one sitting down either, so I'm going to invite you to stand as we sing a couple of stanzas of Lift Up the Trumpet.
Lift up the trumpet and loud let it ring. Jesus is coming again. Cheer up, ye pilgrims, be joyful and sing. Jesus is coming again. Coming again, coming again. Jesus is coming again. Echo it, hilltops, proclaim it, ye plains. Jesus is coming again. Coming in glory. Jesus is coming again. Coming again. Coming again. Jesus is coming again.
You may be seated. I've only got about three or four more songs. The next one, I think you have music over there for maybe Lewis Beulah Land, or you know it at least. You'll follow me. Well, that's bad tonight, but all right. Not just the second coming, but our pioneers 100 years and more ago loved to sing about heaven. And one of the songs that was very popular for many, probably 50, 75 years, was the old hymn, Beulah Land, that was introduced into Adventist hymnody. At least the first hymnal that you find it in was published in 1881 in Better Than Pearls. So we'll do one stanza of Beulah Land. There is a land of corn and wine. You better get your wife over there to sing it, because I'm...
There is a land of corn and wine, and all its joys will soon be mine. There shines undimmed one blissful day, for earth's dark night has passed away. Oh, Beulah Land, sweet Beulah Land, heights I long to stand and view the radiant jasper sea and mansions fair prepared. And find on that eternal shore forevermore.
110 years ago, 120 years ago, Adventism sent its best and brightest, I'm not saying we still don't, but this is when we really got started, sending our best and brightest overseas to spread the message. In other words, our young people were educated to become missionaries. And church after church after church repeated what happened with this young girl in 1901, Anna Knight, who took nursing and education at the Battle Creek Sanitarium and Battle Creek College. I want to tell you just a little bit about Anna, not very much, but just a little bit about her. She was born in So-So, Mississippi, the daughter of a slave. She was born just after the Civil War. And her mother could not read or write. And young Anna decided that she wanted to make something of herself. She wanted to get an education. So the first thing that she did was she got some of the young white kids to do what you were not supposed to do at that time in Mississippi, and that was to teach a black how to read and write. But she got them to teach her just the basics, the very basics, enough so that she could make out sort of what was being said in magazines and all. And back in those days, in the 1870s, 80s, there apparently were magazines that in the back you could write and someone would send you, I mean, you could write for literature and someone would send you stuff for free. And this was a way, because she had no money and she certainly did not have any of her family supporting her in this endeavor. Her mother especially was adamant that she shouldn't, you don't need to learn to read or write. And but Anna was determined. And so she wrote to several people, but only one lady continued to correspond. This lady was a Seventh-day Adventist. And she wrote and sent free literature to Anna Knight. Anna read the literature and decided that the seventh day was a Sabbath. This now really caused problems in her family, because not only was she becoming uppity by learning how to read and write, but she got this strange idea that the seventh day is the Sabbath. That did not deter her. In her autobiography, published in 1950, here's what Anna Knight, how she describes her first Sabbath. She said, "I decided to spend the Sabbath day out in the woods, since there was no home I could go to and keep the Sabbath. When I had prepared breakfast, which was my daily task, and had done my housework, I took my Bible, my Sabbath school worker, Quarterly, Review and Herald, instructor, and my revolver, and went to the woods where I spent the day. During the day, I memorized the Sabbath school lesson and read the papers from cover to cover. My faithful dog, in the meanwhile, watched nearby, never allowing a hog or cow to come near me. Many hard things were said to me," she wrote, "and even threats were made. But I let all know my mind was made up. When I went to the woods, I took my revolver and I could shoot straight." She had made up her mind. She knew what she believed, and nobody was going to deter her from it. Well, in 1901, this young, talented young girl, having completed the nursing course, went to India as a missionary, left Battle Creek, Michigan. And she describes in her autobiography that about 200 people were at the depot to see the train leave Battle Creek for New York City, where Anna would get on a ship and sail to India. Interestingly, you may or may not know this, but the first African-American female missionary of any denomination, Protestant denomination, to go to India was Anna Knight, Seventh-day Adventist young girl. Here's what she says. "The night we left Battle Creek for New York, about 200 people were at the depot to see us off. And there they sang, 'God be with you till we meet again.' And she said, as the train pulled away from the station, there were many hands and handkerchiefs waving farewell. And that scene was repeated over and over and over, as I say, as we sent our best and brightest to the world field, the mission field, to proclaim the three angels' messages." So we'll do one stanza of "God be with you till we meet again." God be with you till we meet again. By His counsel's guide uphold you. With His sheep securely fold you. Be with you till we meet again. Till we meet, till we meet, till we meet at Jesus' feet. Till we meet, till we meet. God be with you till we meet again. Our last hymn that we're going to sing, the last hymn we're going to sing, but still relating to Battle Creek, Michigan. Some of you may know this, recognize the picture, or know the name at least, of this individual, Ira Sankey. Ira Sankey was the singing evangelist. If you don't know Sankey's name, Ira Sankey was the singing evangelist for the great minister evangelist back in that era, Dwight L. Moody. Ira Sankey was a patient at the Battle Creek Sanitarium. He knew Dr. Kellogg well, used to come to the sanitarium. In fact, Ira Sankey was at the sanitarium as a patient the night it died burned on February 18, 1902. His autobiography, he was writing his autobiography, he had it in manuscript form, and it was in his room in the sanitarium when it burned. So he had to rewrite the whole thing because it hadn't yet been printed. But he tells in his rewritten autobiography, about this last hymn that we're going to sing, and that is, "I'll Go Where You Want Me to Go, Dear Lord." Sankey said that there was a group of nurses there at the sanitarium. Now, this would be while the sanitarium was still Seventh-day Adventist, so we're not talking about after Dr. Kellogg took it out of the church. Sankey's talking about Adventist nursing students. He said there was a group of nurses there at the sanitarium who took the hymn, "I'll Go Where You Want Me to Go," and made it their class hymn. And they determined amongst themselves that when they graduated from school, wherever God called them, wherever they were dispersed around the world, every Sunday they would sing this hymn and pray and think about their classmates wherever they were scattered around the world proclaiming the soon return of Jesus. Now, it's not just the mission of Adventist Heritage Ministry to entertain, you know, to entertain us. It's fun to sing these old hymns. It's fun to hear the stories about them. But there's a reason why Adventist Heritage Ministry is trying its best and why the volunteers support this ministry. There's a reason for that, and that's because we believe that the example of the pioneers is worth emulating today. The pioneers were committed to finishing the work, and what we're trying to do is to help tell their story, to help us today to have the same kind of consecration, the same kind of commitment, the same kind of dedication to the proclamation of the three angels' messages that the pioneers of this church had a century or more ago. If all you ever wanted to do was to help restore an old building, go join your local historical society. I don't know a historical society anywhere that doesn't have at least some old building in their community that they're trying to restore. But if you want to start and help restore the mission and message of this church, and you want a place to come do some volunteering, well, sometime get a hold of some of our officers and join us as we're trying to keep alive the history of this church to help a new generation understand about their commitment. And so as we close this evening, I'll invite you to stand as we sing a hymn of commitment, the same hymn of commitment that Ira Sankey talked about back then, "I'll Go Where You Want Me to Go, Dear Lord." So please stand with me as we sing this last hymn.
It may not be on the mountain's height or over the stormy sea. It may not be at the battle's front. My Lord will have need of me. But if by a still small voice He calls to pass, I do not know. I'll answer, dear Lord, I'll go where You want me to go. I'll go where You want me to go, dear Lord, or mountain or plain or sea. I'll say what You want me to say, dear Lord. I'll be what You want me to be. Perhaps today there are loving words which Jesus would have me speak. Be now in the paths of sin some wanderer whom I should seek. O Savior, if Thou wilt be my guide, though dark and rugged the way, my voice shall echo the message sweet. I'll say what You want me to say. I'll go where You want me to go, dear Lord, or mountain or plain or sea. I'll say what You want me to say, dear Lord. I'll be what You want me to be.
May that be the commitment of each one here this evening, is my prayer.
Let us pray. Our Father, we have been blessed tonight. we came to learn about how you led the pioneers of this church. And in some ways, we've learned of the faith of those pioneers that we sometimes question if it's greater than the faith that we have. And yet, looking at what has been shown us today, we know that even if we have some doubts, you have given us more evidence. The fact that we have these people, these leaders, the pioneers to look upon, to see how you led them, reinforces the faith that we have and lets us know that you're more eager to embrace us today as you were those pioneers, and that we can call you our Father, our Redeemer, and our Savior. Thank you. Amen.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International copyright, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministry.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage you. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He is coming soon.